Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Erroneous Jury Instruction Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 25, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Musacchio v. United States. Petitioner Musacchio was convicted in a jury trial on two counts of violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. At trial, the district court had incorrectly instructed the jury that the government had to prove more stringent elements than the statute actually required, but the government had failed to object. On appeal, Musacchio argued that the government had failed to present evidence sufficient to sustain a conviction under this more stringent standard. He also argued that one of the counts on which he was convicted had been barred by a statute of limitations, but had not raised this objection at trial. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit rejected both challenges and affirmed Musacchio's conviction. The question before the Supreme Court was twofold. 1. How should federal courts assess a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence in a criminal case when a jury instruction adds an element to the charged crime and the government fails to object? And 2. Can a defendant successfully raise the general federal criminal statute of limitations for the first time on appeal? By a vote of 9-0, the court affirmed the judgment of the Fifth Circuit, holding that 1. The challenge to sufficiency of the evidence should be assessed against the elements of the charged crime, rather than the elements set forth in the erroneous jury instruction, and 2. The statute of limitations bar could not be raised for the first time on appeal. Justice Thomas delivered the opinion for a unanimous court. To discuss the case, we have Mark H. Bonner, who is Associate Professor at Ave Maria School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Bonner.
My name is Mark Bonner, and I'm an Associate Professor of Law at Ave Maria Law School in Naples, Florida. My purpose today is to discuss a recent opinion of the Supreme Court, Musacchio versus United States, number 14-1095, which was decided on January the 25th, 2016. It's a criminal case, and it involved the crime of accessing a computer without authorization. The opinion is interesting for several reasons. One is it's a unanimous opinion. All nine justices signed on to it, and the opinion was delivered by Justice Thomas. It's also unusual in that it decides two legal issues. Let me tell you what the two issues are, and then I'll discuss them in turn. The issues were sufficiency of the evidence, how to ascertain that, and also an issue concerning the statute of limitations. More particularly, the first issue decided, the court decided that sufficiency of the evidence should be assessed against the elements of the charged crime and not against a jury instruction that added an extra element to the charged crime. And the second issue decided was that the general federal statute of limitations, a five-year statute, may not be raised for the first time on appeal. So as to the first issue decided, sufficiency of the evidence, in a nutshell, Mr. Musacchio had left one company and founded a competing company. And as he left his first company, he brought his old password with him and used it for several years to dip back into his old company's computer. That access was a crime. Now, a criminal statute can be violated usually in several ways. The robbery statute, for example, can be violated by taking personal property from the presence of another against that person's will by force or by violence or by intimidation. So those three are three different ways of committing the same crime. This computer crime can be done two ways. The first way is by obtaining access without authorization, and the other way is by obtaining access with authorization, but then using that authorization, that access, improperly. Now, Mr. Musacchio was ultimately charged with way number one, that is, obtaining access without authorization, and was not charged by committing the crime by way number two. He was ultimately convicted. Well, the jury was charged, however. Now, he's charged with way number one. But the jury, when the jury is instructed, the court instructed the jury that they must find both ways, way number one and way number two, and the jury did. So on appeal to the Fifth Circuit, Mr. Musacchio argued that there was insufficient evidence as to way number two, as to say, really exceeding his access, and therefore that his conviction should be reversed. Now, if a conviction is found on appeal to be based on insufficient evidence, as opposed to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court finding some legal error, but if insufficient evidence is found on appeal, it functions as an acquittal and the defendant cannot be retried. So it's not reversed and remanded for a new trial. The defendant is just effectively acquitted. The reason being that the judgment of the appellate court is basically that a motion for a judgment of acquittal should have been granted before the matter even went to the jury. Now, Mr. Musascio's position was that since the judge had instructed the jury that they must find way one and two together, that therefore his guilt as so defined had not been established because number two had not been proved, that he exceeded access that he had been authorized. The government's position was that the indictment just charged him with way number one, and there was plenty of evidence to show that he had committed way number one. The Fifth Circuit on intermediate appeal to the intermediate level appellate court, the Fifth Circuit said, well, we would ordinarily be required to accept this defendant's position that you look to the jury instructions of way A and B must be proved, even though the trial court really shouldn't have done that, because of a doctrine called the law of the case doctrine. However, the Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, found an exception to the law of the case doctrine for patently erroneous jury instructions, such as this one, and then rejected the defendant's argument and measured the sufficiency of the evidence against the elements of the crime charged. The Supreme Court, on reviewing this case in certiorari, held that the rubric to be used in assessing sufficiency of the evidence is the elements of the offense as expressed in the charge against the defendant. And here, the defendant was charged only with committing this crime by means of way number one. The Supreme Court held that the reviewing court considers only the legal question whether, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, whether any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Reviewing court's limited determination on sufficiency thus does not rest on how the jury was instructed. The government's failure to introduce evidence of an additional element, to wit, way number two, does not implicate the principles that sufficiency review protects. The court did note that it was not suggesting that the government adds an element to a crime for purposes of sufficiency review when the indictment charges different means of committing a crime in the conjunctive. And what they meant by that is this. Again, usually a statute will say, well, robbery is taking property by means of force or violence or intimidation. And in an indictment, usually the government charges that in the conjunctive, that the defendant took the property by force and violence and intimidation. The government has to prove one of those beyond a reasonable doubt in their instructions to deal with it, but charging in the conjunctive doesn't require the government to prove it in the conjunctive, just one of the elements, one of the ways of committing the crime. Right. Now, as to the law of the case doctrine, which is a relatively arcane doctrine, the Supreme Court did give us some guidance on that as well. The Supreme Court ruled that the Fifth Circuit erred in its application of the law of the case doctrine. Recall, the Fifth Circuit had applied the law of the case doctrine to the extent that it required an exception to be found by them in order to avoid it. They say, well, when there's a patent error in the jury instructions, it's obvious, then the law of the case doctrine doesn't apply. Well, the Supreme Court went, first let me tell you what the doctrine is. The doctrine itself generally provides that when a court decides upon a rule of law, that decision should continue to govern the same issues in subsequent stages of the same case. The Supreme Court ruled that this doctrine does not apply, though, as between a trial court and an appellate court. So they said the Fifth Circuit didn't need to find an exception to the doctrine, that the doctrine just doesn't apply at all. And indeed, the function of an appellate court is to review the legal rulings of a trial court. The utility of this rule in a trial court is that once a trial court has ruled on an issue of law, the trial court can't be required to continually revisit that ruling of law. It'll apply to all similarly situated facts before it during the pendency of that litigation. Now, the second major ruling of Musascio concerns the statute of limitations. We have, and we got it from the common law, statutes that say that after a certain period of time, the government has a certain period of time to institute charges against a criminal defendant, or otherwise the criminal defendant can't be prosecuted. It allows people after a while to have a certain amount of repose and peace in their life. Usually there is no statute of limitations for capital cases like murder, but for a regular robbery, theft, cheating, stealing, whatever, after a while the government can't bring charges, so you get a chance to get on with your life. Mr. Musascio was prosecuted on a superseding indictment, returned more than 5 years after his crime. And it looks like he probably had a good argument to be made in the district court about the statute of limitations barring his prosecution on that superseding indictment. Here's what the general federal statute of limitations that's applicable here, it's 18 U.S. Code 3282. Here's what it says, and it's, again, typical of the genre. Except as otherwise expressly provided by law, no person shall be prosecuted, tried, or punished for any offense not capital unless the indictment is found or the information is instituted within 5 years next after such offense shall have been committed. And his indictment, the superseding indictment, was more than 5 years after the offense. So it looks like it's, you know, seriously vulnerable under a raising of the statute of limitations. However, Mr. Musascio did not raise this at trial. He argues it on appeal that, I can raise it on appeal, he says, because it's a jurisdictional bar. So whether or not I raised it or not, the court was without jurisdiction to try me. The Supreme Court says no to that argument. The Supreme Court observed that that such statutes are jurisdictional only if expressly made so by Congress. Some are, but this one isn't. The court cites back to U.S. versus Cook in 1872 and holds that this statute was a matter of defense. The statute of limitations is a matter of defense and must be pleaded or given in evidence by the accused. The Supreme Court reaffirmed that commission of a federal crime within the statute of limitations period is not an element of the offense, and it is up to the defendant to raise the limitations defense. The defendant must press it at the time of trial to insert it into the case. And the court further ruled that a district court's failure to enforce an unraised limitations defense under Section 3282 is not even plain error, that it can't be plain error because there is nothing for it to rule on. The court has no requirement to raise it sua sponte, and unless it's raised, there's no error at all in not referring to it. So it's up to the defendant to raise. A defendant cannot successfully raise the statute of limitations defense in Section 3282 for the first time on appeal. Interestingly, at oral argument, there was some discussion about ineffective assistance of counsel for not having raised the statute of limitations at trial. It was discussed at oral argument, but it didn't make its way into the court's opinion. And part of the reason is there may have been tactical reasons for not raising it, one of which is that the earlier indictment that was superseded had been returned within the statute of limitations and had not been dismissed. So if Mr. Musascio had prevailed on the statute of limitations motion at trial, the government just would have proceeded on the original indictment. And there are some other reasons as well. So what did we learn from Musascio? Three holdings. Number one is that sufficiency of the evidence review is not assessed by reference to jury instructions, but rather by reference to the crime charge. Number two, that the law of the case doctrine does not apply in appellate review of trial rulings. And number three, that the statute of limitations defense in Section 3282 is not jurisdictional, must be asserted at trial, and cannot be plain error if not so asserted. And as a last bit of information, Mr. Musascio is currently a guest at Segoville Federal Correctional Institution in Texas and has a reservation there until September 6, 2019.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.